You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
7 minutes after 10, you are in for a treat. We are doing a radio narration of the life, times, and person of Winnie Madikizela-Mandela this hour. You think you know Winnie? You don't. One or two of you do, because I have a diverse listenership. Many of you who love her don't know the details of why indeed you should love her. And many of you who rightly, because you're entitled to, raise critical questions about her, will be empowered to do so with a level of nuance that you currently do not have. I make those bold predictions because I've got two excellent guests. The first here in the studio is Vashna Jagannath, who's an historian, and we love her. And we are very happy to have on the show, despite the occasion. Vashna, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Eusebius, for having me.
On the line, we also have Karima Brown, who also wears many hats. She's not here today as a broadcaster, although, of course, she is my broadcasting colleague here on 702, but as a very seasoned political journalist, including one that was very involved in the struggle for justice, including also the committee that was responsible for that segue out of prison into the world of freedom of Nelson Mandela, and therefore has lots of her own experiential knowledge in relation to Winnie and the lifetimes and person of Winnie as well. Karima, thank you so much for joining this conversation as well.
Thank you for having me, Eusebius.
Vashna, Winnie was not born Mandela. No. Winnie had a life before she met Nelson. Mm-hmm. I think a really cool starting point for this hour is, pardon the pun, to divorce her from the Nelson Mandela appendage.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that is incredibly important. Part of the problem of nationalist myth-making and stories when we're trying to write histories about our society, about our past, and especially in the sort of freedom moments of any society. What you have is a very flattening out of history. History has to take on a very narrow gendered narrative. You have a heroic narrative of the hero, and the hero cannot have complexity. And if you do have complexity and you cannot be flattened out because you refuse to be quiet, like Ma Winnie used to refuse to be quiet, then you become superfluous to that story. There's many women, even many men, who have been relegated to the dustbins of history because of this. And Ma Winnie had a full life before she met Nelson Mandela. And I think that is something we need to engage with. People often start her life at that moment of when she meets Nelson Mandela. In fact, the famous South African historian Colin Bundy writes in his book that was published, it's the small pocket Chicana books on Mandela's life, and says, you know, she had the looks of a beauty queen. That's all can be said about her. That kind of takes away her entire life. I mean, she appears in all of probably a paragraph in that biography. And one of the lines is this. What it does not take into account was the fact that Winnie Mandela was born into an incredibly important family in the Eastern Cape, in Pondoland. She was born in 1934, 26th of September. She was born into a royal family. She was a Pondo princess. She also was born at a time in the early part of the 20th century when the Eastern Cape was a space that was in the making, like most of South Africa was. And her family, her father, she talks about how her father was very much influenced by the Germans and admired the Germans. And that is not coincidental, as there were many German missionaries in that part of our country. And that's why her name Winifred comes from that German side, which means, interestingly enough, a friend of peace and reconciliation. And so she talks to that very much in her own history when she's talking about herself. She also speaks to the fact that her father taught her all about the Pondo Wars, the Xhosa Wars. He spoke to her about how to be a proud individual. And she, from a very young age, showed a lot of resilience. Winnie Mandela comes from a long line of incredibly powerful women as well. Her mother was the first domestic science teacher in Bizana, first female domestic science. And then Winnie later on becomes the first social worker at Baragwanath Hospital, the first female black social worker at Baragwanath Hospital. So education played a huge part of her life. When her mom passed away when she was a young woman, she had to leave school for a year to take care of the family. But she worked incredibly hard and made sure she got back to school. And she talks very much about her education and the struggles around that. And in 1952, when the Defiance campaign was happening across South Africa, she was at Lovedale College. And she speaks about the struggles around really desperately wanting to be a part of these campaigns and be a part of the revolutionary struggle. She's highly aware of it. She's highly political. She's not coming to her politics because of Mandela. She constantly states this, but people seem to ignore her, I guess, because she's a woman. But she also, very interestingly enough, speaks to the fact that she could not take part in these campaigns because her parents were paying, her father was paying for her to go to school, and what that would have meant financially if she was expelled from school. And that speaks to a lot of the struggles that young people have today, especially during the student movement, where people were torn between being in the student struggle or actually saying, well, my parents have struggled to send me here, I will be quiet and sit this out. And so that was the internal struggles she had. She then goes to Hofmeyr College to study social work. And what is really not, what is unknown about her is, in addition to her desire to study, she was really, really taken and sort of transformed by the experiences she had as a social worker in the various townships in Johannesburg, which she had not seen, the poverty, the suffering of children, the starvation amongst children. She had not seen these social ills as much in the Eastern Cape. And this really transformed her, so much so that when she received a full scholarship to go and study in Boston at an American university, she turned it down to go and work in Baragwanath Hospital. It was a political decision. It was a decision she took because she cared about the society that she found herself in.
That is absolutely amazing, Vashna, because what it suggests is that her experience of the profound injustice in the social and political fabric of this country is something that was rooted in her birth, and simultaneously she also had the privilege of being role-modeled, the kind of agency which many of us were not role-modeled. I had grandparents, for example, who were very deferential towards apartheid authority, who didn't finish school, for example. And so that to me is absolutely fascinating, because it means that by the time she comes to Joburg, like many ANC men, she comes with a political knowledge in her blood.
Yes, exactly. And she continuously mentions this political knowledge that she has. She continuously mentions herself as an individual and her rights as an individual, in addition to having a sense of the importance of fighting the racial struggles and the class struggles. She has a deep sense of how women are viewed in society and how to break that mold and how she as a woman is viewed. Because if her mother was the first domestic science teacher in the town she grew up in, she totally understood in a patriarchal society that that women could make a difference and that women could thread their own path. And she had that instilled in her from a very young age. I mean, she could have, at the age of 12, after her mother passed on, stayed at home and taken care of the house and then got married, which many people do even today. But she still chose to make her own path.
Karima, I want to bring you in here because this connects so beautifully with a touch point in terms of personal biography that you and I have often spoken about, which is, sometimes the most incredible early political connections we get are from moms and dads, older aunts, who are not called political icons because they don't become that famous, but actually who role model to us exactly in the way in which Mawini's long line of interesting and fascinating women in her life had role modeled to her. Last night, for example, we spoke to Elizabeth, who spoke about how Mawini connected with many women across Cape Town, particularly across the Cape Flats, who are working as machinists and who are in the factories, for example. But it's interesting, isn't it, that what Vashna has said is that classic example of how important it is to remember that brilliant women in history do not necessarily sup politics for the first time when they go on a date with men.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the dichotomy around explaining Winnie Mandela of course, is that she was married to a man whom the world has turned into, you know, a reified saint. And so whenever we look at her, we have to cross this big hurdle to get to her. And I think we need to stop that. I think we need to evaluate what she brought to her own life, the lives of people that she touched, and, of course, her remarkable resilience in demanding his release, his unconditional release. And for me, one of the things that really resonate with me is that she always understood the principles around which we needed to wage our struggle. So this constant refrain from the police that Nelson Mandela can be released tomorrow if he renounces violence, you know, just spurred her on to speak to us and to speak to young people and to the women that she met often in Cape Town when her visits were just summarily cancelled. And she insisted on meeting activists and women, particularly in the trade union movement. She would remind us of the fact that ours is first and foremost a political struggle, but yes, that we were involved in armed propaganda and that we needed to become soldiers of Mkhonto we Sizwe. And Winnie Madikizela Mandela, for me, was a woman of action, but also she believed, and she made us believe, Eusebius, that we can defeat the most powerful Boer army on the African continent. Freedom in our lifetime was the message that she conveyed to young women like myself and many women like Elizabeth and others that they organized in factories. And that had absolutely nothing to do with the fact that she was married to Nelson Mandela. That came from her own life, her own interactions, and most importantly, her own struggles against apartheid colonialism. And I think when we remember Winnie Madikizela Mandela, it's important to give her the space and the honor as a revolutionary in her own right.
You know, Vashana, what is so fascinating also is when you are a social worker and you are at the proverbial coal face of how injustice in the state plays out experientially for people on the ground, we seldom see that as a site of political activism. We see it as a place where you are doing remedial work to try and put a plaster over the wounds of those who are physically and mentally wounded by the inherent violence of the apartheid system. But what you have described is both Mawini as a social worker doing that, which is important work on its own if that's all she did for the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. But from there, you also have a grand political identity that emerges. Mm-hmm. Where does the story go to from there? At what point does she then intersect with ANC history as we've come to know it?
Well, she begins to intersect with ANC history as soon as she comes to Johannesburg. And it's with the Sisulu and the Tambo families and so on. And she joins the Women's League and she becomes interested in politics very quickly. However, she is very young. She's only 22 at this point and she's already got her social work degree. She's already been offered these scholarships to travel. And then she meets Nelson Mandela. He sees her at a bus stop one day and he talks about being struck by her absolute beauty, which also is another key feature of her, is her beauty was quite exceptional. And what I have to say about her is that she did not shy away from that, as so many women in politics are meant to. If you are about politics and if you're about serious business and if you are concerned about other people's welfare, then you shouldn't be concerned about yourself. But Mawini actually was concerned about herself. She took care of herself. She looked exceptionally always well-dressed and beautiful, and at the same time she was a revolutionary. Those two aren't, like, you don't have to choose either or, and I thought that was very useful for her, because she refused. In politics, it's fine to be a woman in politics, but you must know your role, and your role is not to be a sexual being, it's not to be a beautiful being, especially if you're a woman. Mm. And she defied that. So he falls in love with her, and very quickly she writes about how everyone says, oh, did she get political from that? There's a fantastic interview she does in the 1980s. And she says, no, she says, I already had my politics. In fact, we never spoke about politics because we spend so little time together. So she was getting it from the Lillian Ngoyi's. She was getting it from the Women's League. She was very, very much influenced by those politics. And she has a beautiful thing here, which I hope you don't mind if I read it to you, from one of her books. where she says here, and I think this is really important, where she talks about her decision to enter fighting and her decision to become absolutely militant about this. She says, I was aware of the fact that I suddenly discovered, oh, I have no name now. Everything I did as Mandela's wife. I lost my individuality. Mandela's wife said this. Mandela's wife was resisted. It did not matter who the hell I was. It did not matter that I was Madikizela. It did not matter that I was a human being. And it was understandable to the oppressor that whatever they did to Mandela's wife, she deserved it. So I thought, my goodness, I've grown up a princess in my own home. I've come from the royal house of Pondoland, and suddenly I've lost my identity because of the struggle. I am going to fix them. I will fight them and I will establish my own identity. I did that deliberately. I said I was not going to bask in his shadow and be known as Mandela's wife. They were going to know me as Zaniwe Madikizela. I fought for that. I said I will not even bask in his politics. I'm going to form my own identity because I never did bask in his ideas. I had my own mind.
And that's exactly why I've been underscoring something that I do feel very passionate about this morning, Vashna, which is the idea of filling a vacuum, which is an underhanded compliment. But as a Madikizela, as a social worker, mm-hmm. as a politically conscious young woman mm-hmm. at that, you already have political agency in full throttle.
Exactly.
And you are not merely filling the vacuum when the man has gone off, whether it be to war, mm-hmm. whether it be to the mines, mm-hmm. or whether it be incarcerated.
Exactly. And not to also mention the fact that she did the work of filling the vacuum of Nelson Mandela, because not in the sense that she was now taking his place, the fact that Mandela was absent from South Africa, but she continuously reminded us of his presence. Mandela didn't go to Robben Island alone. There were many other people that went to Robben Island with Mandela, but the name that everyone remembers, and by the 1980s comes to know much more than anyone else, Sisulu or Tambo or anyone, is Nelson Mandela. And that is the work that Winnie did in keeping his name alive, in making sure he wasn't forgotten. So not only was she carving her own political path and becoming a revolutionary in her own right, she ensured that whatever revolutionary credentials Mandela had when he went into jail was remembered and continued to grow.
Karima, I want to invite you to reflect on the second theme around Ma Winnie that I wanted us to lift to the surface, which is the peculiar sacrifices and challenges that come with not being able to give full attention to certain roles that you may love or that are imposed on you by society, such as parenting or parenting alone. And this is something that obviously you are profoundly aware of as well. So many South Africans in small ways and in big ways had this horrible choice, not choice really, but conditions of history imposed on you, where sometimes it's a question between leaving in the early hours of the morning and paying full attention to taking your kids to the school, explaining to your children why they can't see dad or can't see dad as often. And when she is rendered mother of the nation, we forget that she was also mother to children. Give us some texture in terms of the challenges of mothering in the context of the lifetimes and person of Winnie.
You know, you see this, it's probably one of the most underwritten and under-explained parts of what constitutes our society. For me, often when I think about the apartheid system in its totality, and when I look at what we experience as a society, I constantly get so angry at the destruction of black family life. And of course, Winnie Madikizela Mandela is one among millions of South Africans whose lives were irrevocably changed as a result of a system that was described as a crime against humanity. But I think, you know, there are instances in history where Winnie Madikizela Mandela is forcibly removed from her home when the police come and harass her. And of course, she's terrified that her two young daughters are left alone. And I have seen various images and films where, you know, she fights physically with police to be able to hold on to her children, to be able to know that they're going to be okay. And on the occasions, and this is the other thing that people don't realize, Winnie Madikizela Mandela was in prison. She was banished and her children were taken from her. And I think that it is something that for me became clear at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You know, it was, I was at the session where Archbishop Tutu begged Mawini to speak to what happened with Stompie. But preceding that, you had Zinzi giving testimony of what was happening at their lives. Their childhood was taken from them. Their mother was taken from them. They were adults from the time they were very little. And of course, that is not unique, but it was exemplified and elevated in the case of Mandela. And the story there, if you go back to the transcript, if you listen to Zinzi's growing up, her interface with the men in her mother's life, in her home, then you can see the loss of innocence, the loss of a childhood. And there is no, there is nothing that can fix that, Eusebius. There is no amount of penance that can explain the destruction of black family life. And if apartheid is ever to be held accountable for one thing, it is that. It is the breaking of families and the tortured lives and the generational pain that carries from one generation to the next. If you read someone like Zoleka Mandela's book about her struggle with cancer, her struggle with sexual abuse, then you can see how the innocence was just gone. And to parent in conditions like that, where you are expected to lead the entire country, but you can't ensure the safety of your little girl when you are forcibly taken from your home. Those are things that many of us have lived with for many years. And we haven't even begun as a society to talk about how we fix that. And
compounded, Karima, compounded by two simultaneous things, I would imagine. The natural instinct of a parent, plus the professional knowledge of a social worker of what these conditions do to children.
Absolutely. And of course, you sit with that guilt. You sit with that sense of failure. You sit with that sense of you couldn't protect your own child. I mean, any parent will know exactly what that feels like. It's a powerlessness that renders you paralyzed. And for someone like Winnie Madikizela Mandela and other women to be in that situation, you know Rayhana Rousseau, the author. I remember when Rihanna was detained under Section 29, she had just had Jihad, her young son, and she demanded that she wanted him with her in jail. And we had a big discussion about whether it's the right thing for him to be there, but she wanted her child with her because she felt that she was able to then at least be there and if anything happened. So those were the choices that women were often confronted with. And someone like Winnie Madikizela Mandela, of course, had to constantly live that.
Absolutely.
And also, you know, people forget what it was like to go to Robben Island. The big boats that you use now, those weren't the boats. The most horrific little dinghies were there. People got violently ill, and these children would be on the boats. And then you would come there, and the visit would be summarily cancelled, you know. And you would have to explain to your child why you were not able to see your parent, and to be able to not do anything about it. That sense of powerlessness is personally there. But I think it also accounts for why she was so determined to fight Eusebius and why she was so relentless about resistance.
Okay, when I pick up on that relentlessness quality as well and why it's double-edged, some people use that in one of the ways in which they flatten her place in history. I actually think it's a positive trait and I want to lift it to the surface. But in the meantime, it's 10:30 and you do not want to go anywhere. Like I said to you, this is it's a radio treat. Absolutely brilliant. Karima Brown with me and Vaishna Jagannath. I'm going to say it until she eventually agrees. She needs to have a history podcast. We can listen to her the whole day. 10:30
Tobias McKaiser
on your number one news and talk station.
The life, times and person of Winnie Madikizela-Mandela this hour, and I am with historian Vashna and also with Karima, political reporter and analyst. And Karima was talking before the break there about the challenges of mothering in this particular historical context, including the added layers and secondary trauma that comes with being in this little boat. You're seasick, you go to Robben Island, and at the whim of some constable, you may not even see your dad that is there, and what that does, not just to dad and to children, but also to the mother that had hoped for that little bit of moment. And I want to play this clip that nicely segues from there into another aspect of the challenges that Ma Winnie faced.
I dealt mostly with children. I handled the worst of our malnutrition cases. I dealt with hunger, with poverty directly. I was involved with my community at grassroots level. And it was one of the most painful things for me to be in touch with the reality of our country's problems, the rife unemployment, the poverty of the people, and the fact that there was no way of changing those conditions other than changing the whole status quo. There were socioeconomic problems of a depraved society.
Because she looks regal, we often forget that the other contextual, structural fact about her life and times was the violence of poverty.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's absolutely correct. And, you know, people, what people forget about apartheid was it rendered people poor. It put people who would have been in otherwise in a normal society would have been she was royalty. So they would have been elite. They would have had a society. They'd have a role in society. But they render you, apartheid rendered all black people worthless and poverty-stricken many people. And she had to encounter this not because of any lack of her ability in society or the ability of Nelson Mandela in society, but they had to experience this more so than most people because it was imposed by the state directly. People forget, you know, like Karima was saying earlier, that Ma Winnie was imprisoned, she was banished. What people forget about her is that she faced every form of punishment that the apartheid state could do onto someone. She had surveillance, solitary confinement, imprisonment, house arrest, and banishment. She was banished to Brandfort. And if anyone's been to Brandfort, it is I'm so sorry to offend anyone, but it's a bleak place. I mean, I traveled there recently a few years ago, and it was bleak then. And she had to encounter this incredibly hard life in the harshest of conditions, in an incredibly hostile environment, in a racist environment in the Free State. But, you know, Ma Winnie, one of the things about her is her resilience. She didn't, even when she got to Brandfort, she did not just like sit around and sort of languish in this condition, which is what they were hoping to do. They were hoping to, because with banishment, what they do is they take you out of a condition that you know, that you are familiar with, and they put you into a condition that is completely alien to you. But even then she thrived. She opened clinics immediately. You know, she set up things. She got people organized in Brandfort. She brought politics to Brandfort. She didn't just sit and languish. And one of the things about Ma Winnie that we forget, and you all touched on this earlier on when you spoke about her as a social worker, is that she was always reflective, not just about the damage that it was doing to her children, but the damage that this apartheid state had done to herself. She understood that the system of apartheid was an abomination and that that was the wrong system. When she comes out of solitary confinement, she gives an interview and says, they broke something in me in solitary confinement. She knew they had broken something in her in the 1980s. She says, I was a social worker. I loved people. I loved working with people. I wanted to, but they broke something in me. She was fully cognizant of the damage that apartheid was doing to her. And I think that was behind her militancy. And that was why when it came to 1994 and everyone was excited and everyone was going along, she was saying, hold up. This is a problem. And interestingly enough, she proved to be quite, it proved to be quite telling in the last 20 years of the post-apartheid state. And that is why she continued to fight. She didn't decide now is the moment and we are okay, everything is fine, because she understood the deep-seated evils of apartheid and what it was doing to society as a whole. And many of those symptoms we are still playing out today in post-apartheid South Africa. The violence, the problems with gender violence in our society, the problems of poverty, the problems of inaccessibility to education. All of those things she understood you did not have a quick fix solution for.
Before we talk about how she was profoundly aware of the way in which solitary confinement damaged her, Karima, as Vashna is talking about the different ways in which she was harassed by the apartheid government and tortured by the apartheid government, ways in which so many people glibly forget to hit the pause button over. Yeah. I'm taken back to that beautiful book, and I'm glad to see it's longlisted for the Ellen Payton, No Longer Whispering to Power, the story of Thuli Maroncela by Thandeka Qubule. And one of the beautiful moments there, which almost had me in tears when Thandeka was here, is how when Thuli was in prison, one of the most important things to do when you are in your single cell and you are alone is the 45 minutes or so that you get to be in communion with other women. And singing was such an important part of solidarity. The apartheid bastards understood very well, didn't they, that connection and community is a key part of black identity and political praxis. And that in part is why banishment and isolation work so well.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, we had different types of detentions and banishment. So, for example, Mawini was banished and she was cut off. And what Vashna was saying that is instead of languishing there and becoming isolated, she recreated community. She recreated the connection because our responsibility at that time was always to mobilize people. And she did it, of course, through the clinics. What is so interesting for me, Eusebius, you know, Elizabeth, who was on the show last night, is a former clothing worker and a member of the former Garment Workers Union. And she was arrested too in Mitchell's Plain, and I had been arrested. And the police said to me, they are going to put me in a cell with a crazy person that is going to drive me crazy, because the whole point was to mess with my head so that they could interrogate me. And then, of course, I got into the cell, and lo and behold, there was Elizabeth with a broken leg in a cast. So this idea sometimes of, you know, isolating people and putting them, you know, in places where they are not able to connect sometimes backfired, because I was actually so relieved, because there was a senior person in the cell, someone who could guide me. I was the only female that was arrested, with about six or seven men, and Elizabeth was the supposed crazy person that the police had said they were going to put me with, you know. But the point about solitary confinement is this, because Section 29 is was this notorious act. It allowed the police to put you in a jail for 6 months without having access to a lawyer, your family, and it is basically just a period. To break you. And normally what would happen is you would be charged after that, either with treason or sedition or something like that. And many people were put in those conditions. And the idea was there to isolate you, to mess with your head, but most importantly, to break your spirit. Winnie Madikizela Mandela's entire life was the struggle to prevent the apartheid state from stealing and breaking her humanity and her spirit. And she paid the price for that. Her children, her family paid the price. But at the public level, she held that line, so much so that she became an icon for people such as us and millions of others. But privately, I think that she must have suffered from post-traumatic stress.
Yes.
She must have had a nervous breakdown. Absolutely. But, you know, we don't talk about those things, because that doesn't happen to
Absolutely. Me. Okay, I'm going to take a break here. Just way too many awesome tweets. Thank you. Thank you so much for this. Keisha says, thank you, CBS, for unpacking the different facets of Winnie Madikizela Mandela. I'm angry, happy, inspired, and crying all the same. What a woman. No, me too. And I'm just from the Peanut Gallery. It's the brilliance of Karima and Vashna. And if you think that we're going to end there, no, we're not. Last night, between myself, Karima, and Vukani, we talked ourselves into a wonderful lighthearted moment that I'm going to unravel for longer with Vashna and Karima now. And that is to tell you why, in fact, contrary to what the young ones think, Winnie was woke before the word existed.
You're CBS Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Vashna, the last couple of years, the world over, rage is all the rage. Rage for its own sake is probably not very meaningful, although an expression of rage can be morally appropriate, but particularly in service of justice. Many young people in America and here in South Africa and in England and parts of Europe now, they think they're the first ones to tap into the strategic and the moral value of rage. Mawini's been doing it.
I mean, I think what we have to understand, and this speaks to the sort of problem that we have now, I think it's been a problem a lot throughout most of history, is people don't look to the past. They don't think what has come before them. I remember a few years ago we were sitting together and talking about how the current generation of young people, the youth today, talk about the 1990s and the 94s as if we were not woke, as if we had not made choices, as if we all lacked agency, that we're all duped, right? And they at the same time admire Mawini, who was an individual who was not duped, who was constantly saying, guys, this is not the way to go. And that rage that she had came from a very real place. I'm not saying that a lot of the rage that's experienced today does not come from a real place. Racism is massive. It still goes, we are not allowed to even speak about it in a lot of circles. It's still seen as impolite, but it continues in every possible way throughout Europe, our South Africa, North America, and so on. But Mawini's rage comes from all of the brutality she faced. She was in a war. People forget that South Africa in the 1980s was a zone of war. They try to flatten it out. It's also, there's a deep concentration on exile history and the history of those who were imprisoned. And as a result, you don't look at what was happening on the ground in South Africa. And I would argue that someone like Mawini faced far harsher conditions being on the ground, dealing with the police every day, than maybe staying on Robben Island. I'm not saying that that was not difficult and hard and whatever, but I'm saying is that there was an incredibly difficult situation that she was faced with. Often the tendency is, and this started in the post-94 moment, to cast her as some brutish presence in our politics and in our society. And you could see that immediately beginning to happen, the way they would show pictures of her in the newspaper, always of her scowling and being angry and ugly. So she's this enraged, brutish presence that we have to put away. We have to close up. And actually, interestingly enough, that rage comes out, because rage will always come out because it has not been dealt with properly. And it comes out in South Africa through the student movement, through a variety of things. And
but also, the same rage in male bodies come out differently. I remember in Matric writing a history essay on the question, describe the reasons why the ANC took up the armed struggle. But the subtext, we didn't use that kind of language at school, but the subtext of the teachings that had led up to that exam question is that it was a morally good decision, was morally upright.
Yes.
But you have a picture of any of the ANC women, and one of the, I think there's one of Lindiwe Zulu that does this, with a gun in her hand, and suddenly it invites a different viewing.
Exactly. That's because women have particular roles in society. So as the good wife who's doing the work behind the scenes, who's making the coffee, who's printing the documents, who's setting up the room, who's archiving, who's doing secretarial work, that's really good. Continue with that. But women have no place in war, apparently. And we were in an armed struggle, and Winnie Mandela was raging that armed struggle. So you expect her to be violent, because that was it. But her violence is not seen as heroic. It's viewed as something that's incorrect and out of place. She was dealt with far harshly than any of the men were dealt with, who did far worse things, who did far worse acts of violence. Even when Tutu sort of makes this appeal to her, he's appealing to her as a woman, as a mother. He doesn't do the same appeals to men, because that sort of idea for men is that, oh, men don't appeal to these sets of things. So she's, as a woman, I need to appeal to her womanly side, not to her as a soldier, not to her as someone who's fighting a war. And I think this speaks to the general problem we have in our society. Even with Nelson Mandela, this flattening out of history, they don't consider his rage. He is a rageless person. He exists without rage. So the problem even is to demonstrate to young people today that Mandela was filled with rage, and Mandela was the leader of Umkhonto we Sizwe, and he made the decision to take up an armed struggle, and he was incredibly tough on that. But we have flattened him out as a sort of happy grandfather who miraculously just, I don't know, through sitting in prison, got South Africa saved, and was not someone who could whip you in the ANC, not someone who could bring you to order, but Ma Winnie becomes that antithesis and she has to be put away.
The last thing I want us to discuss, Karima and Vashna, and I'm going to devote 5 minutes to this so you two can interrupt each other here. We'll have to come back to this topic, Karima, is of course that she was also deeply flawed. I am I can't tell you how much I've loved this last hour with the two of you, because as I said to my team, I wanted us to do an appreciative piece and not just a bunch of rebuttals against flat descriptions of her. But Vashna said to me that she wants to talk about Stompy. She wants to talk about the moral flaws, because one can do that and also be appreciative. Enter that conversation with me, and then Vashna, you can engage with Karima.
Look, I think we need to realize, like Vashna said, we were in a war. We were in a situation where we did things that were morally not always okay. And we need to look at the lenses of that time, or we need to use lenses at that time. If we take, for example, our constitutional lens now that we are still working towards, and we look at what happened in the past, then obviously we are going to fall flat. But we were in a messy situation, and we must never forget that. You know, Mac Maharaj years ago said to me, what do people think we were doing? Mm. We were involved in killing. Mm. We were involved in abductions. We were involved in bombing. And you know, there are two people in the South African public imagination that white people saw a single out for hatred, because they refused to cow down and they refused to say that we were not involved in a war of liberation. It's Robert McBride and Winnie Madikizela Mandela. There's a particular attitude. And you know why that is, Eusebius? It's because they took the war to whites. Mm-hmm. They took the war to the enemy. And they were not apologetic for it. They were understanding that their armed struggle was superseded by a political understanding. Our fight was principally a political one, but we had an armed propaganda unit as part of it. So yes, Winnie made mistakes. The mess that happened in Soweto around the football team, around Stompy, is something that we must reflect on. There are journalists, for example, I said yesterday, I didn't want to mention her name simply because of the victimization that she faced. She was brave enough. She called Ma Winnie out. She called out Jenny Richardson and the thuggery that went on there. There was a time when comrades were worried that the people of Soweto were going to burn down her house. People like Azur Kachalia, people like Murphy Morobi, people like Vali Musa had to publicly disown the actions of that football club. But like Lebohang said yesterday, when we look at Shea, when we look at Lenin, when we look at Karl Marx, when we look at Fidel, we see them as heroes. But they were flawed.
Yes.
And I think the exact same thing can be said of Winnie Nomzamo Madikizela Mandela. She is a hero. She's flawed. She's not a saint. She's not a sinner. She's a regular person who did extraordinary things.
Vashna, last 2 minutes for you.
I could not agree more with Karima. And I think what Karima says is they were in a messy situation. And we must always remember that that messy situation was not of their own making. It was a messy situation that was imposed onto them by the apartheid state. They were trying the best they could to liberate their people and all of us in this context, in a context where there was huge oppression, there was huge violence against people. And I think we need to speak to, and no one wants to, you know, when people die, there's always this like, let's remember the good, don't speak bad about the dead and all of that nonsense. No one's trying to do that here. And I think this is very important, especially for people who want to just glibly say, Ma Winnie was just this murderer or this horrible person. We don't engage her anymore in society. I think what we have to understand is that we're not glossing over the difficulties of Winnie Mandela's life. We are actually engaging those difficulties and those details of her life. And we should not just do that to her. We should do it to everyone, because then we come to understand what the true struggle was, how difficult it is to actually struggle, how difficult it is to actually liberate yourself, how difficult it is actually to transform society. It is not something easy. It is not something that is done by sitting around writing petitions and so on, especially when a state is as repressive as that one is. And if we don't look at those details and we don't engage history in a manner that seeks to reveal rather than just to have a narrative, then what we find is we continue to make those same mistakes. We continue not to understand how human beings act in particular conditions. And I think if we want to move forward as a society, that is the work we definitely need to do. And if we certainly want to address issues of gender, then we have to use the life of 100%. Winnie Madikizela-Mandela, because she is an incredible woman who lived her life fully. She went dressed up to the revolution. She had lovers. She fought. She, you know, did everything that needed to be done. She took on policemen continuously. And in all of that, she was an incredibly loving, kind person. If you met her in person, she was so gentle and kind and loving that you just felt happy after seeing her. So there's all of those things that she embodied.
Well, Karima, you're a brilliant political journalist, and you yourself are a brilliant historian. So to Karima and to Vashna,
thank you.
This is what I have to say. Thank you.